There was George Allen speaking in Southwest Virginia. He was looked upon as a very likely, significant candidate for president. And somebody with their somebody just filming took this moment where he started, I guess, badgering somebody who was filming him, calling him macaca. And that got on the news, but it was really bottom-up type news. And it ended up cratering his candidacy. So to talk about this, we have first Don Tapscott, who is not on your program for this. He has been at the Ideas Festival and some other sessions. Don is the president and founder of New Paradigm, Inc., which is in Toronto, based in Toronto. He's written a large number of books, Paradigm Shift. The most recent one, and one that is in the bookstores, is called Wikinomics, and applying the concept of wiki and collaboration to business, to processes. And he'll go into that and what Web 2.0 is. Then I have Chris Sacca, or we have Chris Sacca, from Google, YouTube, and Chris is the, well, Google.
We're slash YouTube now?
Yeah, right. Well, for this purpose, because we think of YouTube in this connection. And Chris is the head of New Initiatives. He's one of the leading strategists for Google. He has a legal background and was in left a Silicon Valley law firm to go into a streaming video business. And
you don't have to talk about my illegal background.
Oh, okay. And is a new Crown Fellow of the Aspen Institute. We're very proud of that. And another Aspen Institute connection is one of our trustees and great friend, Linda Resnick, who is a, I just like to say, marketing genius. She is the marketing brains behind Palm Wonderful, if you've seen that, or some of the Palm around the Palm teas around the
and the supplements campus you're all taking.
And Teleflora and Fiji Water and various other
everybody's
products.
Nuts.
Everybody's
you
nuts.
You knew so that you already. Hi, darling. How are you?
Dave, then will be David Kirkpatrick, who is a technology writer and senior editor at Fortune Magazine, and also the brains behind a function called Brainstorm. Some people here have been to that. It's a Fortune conference that involves, looks at new technology and other cutting edge issues. And finally, Rick Stengel, who is managing editor of Time Magazine. He's the person who put you on the cover of Time Magazine.
That's right. So I want you all to thank me for that.
Yay!
And was with Time Magazine, then went to head the National Constitutional Center in Philadelphia, and now is back as the editor-in-chief. So, Don, tell us about what is this phenomenon of Web 2.0, and why do we think of it in connection with news?
Okay. First of all, I gave a luncheon talk here. Those who were at that talk, would you put up your hand, please? Okay. I just hate being...
Are you on?
Do we have a microphone? Am I louder now?
No.
Maybe you can...
Check. Testing. Well, let me begin by congratulating each of you personally for having been selected by Time as the person of the year. In fact, I think you should give yourself a big round of applause.
Yay.
Very well done. Seriously, there's a big change in terms of what's happening with the media. And let me just lay out some groundwork here. The old media, print, radio, television, broadcast, had a number of characteristics. They were all centralized, they were one to many, and they were one way. As such, they were controllable. You could control stuff like quality. You could also control content. You've maybe heard the pejorative expression, freedom of the press is a great idea, especially when you own a press. But what we've had with the rise of the digital media is the antithesis of all that, a media that is not centralized, it's highly distributed, it's not one way, it's one to many, or one-to-one or many-to-many. And it's highly malleable, and it will sort of be what we want it to be. It sort of cherishes this awesome neutrality. And then the internet is moving into a second generation that's been referred to as the Web 2.0. The old web of the dot-com period was based on a standard called HTML, and that was a standard for the presentation of information, which is why during the dot-com period, you heard everybody talking about websites and eyeballs and stickiness and clicks, and content was king. See, that's what companies did, is they created a website where they would present content. Now we have this new web that's based on something called XML, and that's not a platform for presentation, it's a platform for computation. The web, in a sense, is becoming a giant global computer. And when you go onto the web, you are, in a sense, programming this this giant computer. So that's creating a platform for people to self-organize. And it's affecting every institution in society. And media has been referred to as sort of the canary in the mine shaft. Now, what we're talking about here in terms of technologies is not just blogs, although that's the first thing that comes to your mind. And there's a new blog created every second of the day, 24 hours of the day. But we've also got a number of other new collaborative media where everyone can create and generate their own content, and they can also collaborate around that content. So the rise of wikis would be a good example. Wikipedia, the original London bombings for 3 days, the best source for journalists around the world to find out what was going on was actually Wikipedia, and that's where journalists went to find out. It was within 17 minutes of the first bomb going off in London, there was an entry into this encyclopedia. You've got things like YouTube, which you're all familiar with. Now, in a sense, that's a platform for the presentation and creation of news. You've got stuff like Current TV, Al Gore's initiative, where there's a little guideline on how to create a great news clip. And you should make it 3 to 4 minutes long, and here's how you do the lighting, and have a sense of presence, and here's how you close it off with a punchy ending. And then you put that up onto the Current TV website, and there's this thing called collaborative filtering where people can vote, and if they decide that it's a really great news clip, it actually gets broadcast on the Current TV network. This goes on and on. I mean, you have things like travel sites. Rather than reading Condé Nast, which is a great travel magazine, you might also want to do what my wife does, which is when we go to a hotel, she actually goes on to one of these websites where people are evaluating the hotel and will suggest an actual best room in the hotel to stay in. So this is travel journalism that is essentially being user-generated. And then the really big one that's coming on the horizon now, I think, or a big one, is social networks. So 85% of all college students are on Facebook. MySpace, I was just with the executive last week, is growing and has been for a year at 2 million new members a month. Sorry, a day. No, well, let me get that right. 2 million new members a week. And they have over 200,000 members on MySpace. Now, not all of those are sort of active members, but this is an extraordinary thing that's been happening. And I'll just end with a little story that kind of makes a big point for me, which is on Christmas Day, I gave an advance copy of my new book to my son, Alex. It's called Wikinomics. And he went off, and he's 20 years old. He's a junior in college. And he went off, came back a couple hours later, and said, "Hey, Dad, this is actually a good book." You know. So, but he says, "I think I'm going to create a community on Facebook." I said, "Do you mind if I watch?" 15 minutes later, he's created the Wikinomicists of the World Unite community on Facebook. Another 15 minutes later, he's got 6 members. By the time we're eating turkey on Christmas Day, he's got 130 members in 7 countries, a president, secretary, chief information officer for the community. He has 7 regional coordinators. He sent out a PDF of the first 2 chapters of the book. I got kids writing back in saying, "Mr. Tapscott, we found errors in your book." And and the community is placing demands on me. Exactly how will Mr. Tapscott be creating value for our community? So the point, this is in addition to being humbling, the point here is that self-organization has really been around throughout human history. Language was developed through self-organization. There was no central committee that said this will be called a pen. It just kind of happened. But now, because of this new global collaborative medium, the Web 2.0, what used to take place over millennia can happen very quickly, and you can build a community in 7 countries. A 20-year-old can do that. And this community is now discussing all kinds of stuff related to Wikinomics. And I was just reading it, Alex, my son, invented this term that actually has to do with the topic that we're talking about here, you know, soldiers in Iraq. Forget about embedded media. Soldiers in Iraq are actually blogging what's going on. And the term he uses, soldiernalism, well, I don't know if that's going to get through the neologism committee of the community, but soldiernalism is a new phenomenon that's happening. Okay, so there are a million problems, and I'm sure they'll come up, but that's kind of the context.
So, Chris, when we think of citizen journalism and going having input, we go to YouTube and say, well, what's on? Well, a lot of us do. You know, something comes on, something happens, and you want to look for some footage. People often go to YouTube. But how do you all look at citizen journalism? Are you trying to encourage it? And in the course of this with Google, I know that you're really the source of funding for some of these news sites that are trying to come on.
Sure. I actually disagree. I don't think anyone goes to YouTube to look for that yet. Okay. I think they will, but I think it's still early. I think even those of us who work with it every day don't actually go there for that kind of information yet. You know, I think of, just to go back and kind of play off your comments a little bit, I think of the difference between Web 1.0 and Web 2.0 as this. I think Web 1.0 was about business, and Web 2.0 is about products. So Web 1.0 was all the MBAs, and Web 2.0 is all the engineers, and we fired all the MBAs. And I think what we found is that it's removed all these layers, and that Web 1.0, we used to go and do deals and, you know, and try and buy some content and do this exclusive thing, that exclusive thing, and now we've built all these platforms that allow a direct connection, user to user, user to the public. I know that when I think of citizen journalism, I still don't think of YouTube, actually. I still think of blogging. And I think of some things I'll mention that have evolved in the text messaging space. But the power of blogging is, I think, still cresting a little bit, in that we are starting to see, just last year I was at a conference here, saw something that struck me, wrote a blog post. My blog has about 10 to 20,000 regular readers, but over the course of the last year, that blog post has been seen about 1 to 1.1 million times. I actually got a note from an editor-in-chief of a major magazine that said they use it as the basis for a feature that they just wrote. And it was a blog post I'd put up on an impulse while I was supposed to be paying attention. I was actually sitting in the back of one of these rooms, and I quickly typed something up and threw it up. I wrote something about John McCain last year while here at the same time last year, basically flip-flopped his position on creationism. And while he was down here, he was a little bit more liberal, and when he was back raising money with a bunch of conservatives around, he was a lot more conservative, and I kind of called him out on it. And that ended up being seen about 200,000 times and cited in papers, and I saw links coming from around the world on that. Yeah, exactly. It was at your conference. Yeah, sorry. And it was. And again, I probably should have been paying attention, not blogging, but I
guess. It's okay. We had Wi-Fi.
Yeah, but it was amazing the scale with which my message could all of a sudden be reached. And it was certainly up to the audience to determine whether I had any credibility or not. But some of those raw nuggets of data that I put out there were then either replicated in derivative works were built either by other bloggers or by professional journalists. And it was amazing to see the scale that was achievable. What's fun is that in that last year, I have personally evolved to where, if you go to my blog, I actually don't blog that much anymore. I have evolved to something even more immediate called Twitter. And Twitter is a platform by which I send out text messages of fewer than 140 characters. And they go to a bunch of people who subscribe to my text messages. And they get an update on whatever just happened to me. And it can be anything from something ironic, like the other day I was waiting for my luggage in the luggage carousel, and a guy picked up a leopard skin print bag, to go walk away with it, and then looked at it twice and realized it actually wasn't his. His must have been some other leopard skin bag. I was like, you know, how often does that happen? But yeah. Or actually, a few weeks ago, I witnessed in San Francisco, I witnessed a guy get shot right before my eyes, and the very first reaction I had to go ahead and communicate that experience was to pull out my BlackBerry and quickly just share what it just was, the surreal moment.
Those two experiences, I think, are two contrasting aspects of citizen journalism. One is a news item. You know, somebody's shot, that is, you know, really what we get on the news these days. The other is, okay, that's a kind of an interesting comment that is really, a lot of these news sites have, I went on a nice hike today and was pretty outside, or something like that. I mean, yeah, literally, that was on one of them.
But honestly, I don't distinguish between those two in terms of what I want to express to the people in my community. And one of them may end up scaling more than the other. You know, one may, by basis of its humor or its serendipity, be interesting to people. Another one may be, you know, the shooting story ended up taking on a life of its own and getting linked to a lot. But I, as a user, don't distinguish between them much. And I think that's something that we're seeing a generational shift where it used to be we had very distinct categories for when we were being serious and when we were at play. And I actually think YouTube is a great example of where we don't distinguish that deeply between the two. We consume content, and some of it's very compelling in a social justice framework, and some of it's just funny. But I think the key here is that we've built these platforms now that allow one author, without any pre-existing credential, no one's asking me, you know, where I went to school or what my parents' last name is or anything like that, to go ahead and publish and to go ahead and express. And if you do that on a frequent basis, if you do that with things that are witty or somehow insightful, you can actually build up an audience very quickly. It's been fun. I have a younger brother who's an actor, and for a long time I was very depressed about his prospects, and mostly because I was paying his monthly rent check. But he was, you know, he'd do off-Broadway show after off-Broadway show, and he'd get really excited because maybe an industry person might show up and he might get some kind of audition or callback or something like that. And as the web came along, he built a website and started using platforms like YouTube, and YouTube particularly, to put up funny videos he was doing with his friends. Within a year, he actually had videos that were seen by millions and millions of people. He was featured at the Aspen Comedy Fest here this spring. He's now got contracts doing writing and development deals and shows and ads and that kind of stuff, and all without any middleman, without any agent trying to bring that to him, et cetera. And I'm seeing that happen across the spectrum now with these platforms. And that's what this new era of Web 2.0 means to me.
So all these inputs by people all over the world and opportunities for self-expression, but sometimes there's a dark side to it. And Linda, I think you saw that.
I saw the dark side. So here I am running all these companies, the marketing worldwide of these companies, and I'm in a unique position in the world today because I'm a grandma in cyberspace, quite frankly. And I have the history of what business used to be like when there was a real model and you had to make money and it was a totally different world. And now what's happening today, the whole paradigm of business in corporate America has changed completely. And I like to say that since Julius Caesar stood in the forum and addressed the people of Rome, no slaves, no women, of course, but the people, there hasn't been a two-way conversation between government, between commerce, and the user. And it's a very exciting time to be alive. I mean, I'm thrilled. But I also have learned a lot, because in public relations, corporate America was always told to be quiet and it'll pass. So let me tell you a story of being quiet and it won't pass. We were attacked by PETA. Last summer, I was not only attacked by the Aspen newspapers, for those of you that were here, but also by the PETA organization.
Tell me what PETA is.
PETA is, I don't even know what it stands for. What? I'm sorry you know that.
Everybody knows that.
Except me. All right, I think it's a mental block. All right. So we were plagued with a horrible internet trashing campaign, and they discovered that our medical research testing on pomegranate juice, we had sacrificed some lab rats and mice in our quest to find the positive effects of drinking pomegranate juice on prenatal brain damage and lowering the PSA in men who had prostate cancer or were afraid of getting prostate cancer. Okay, and just to tell you that those results are staggering that we do keep PSA down. You can go to our website and see. I mean, these were very positive studies. And women that drink pomegranate juice during, you know, carrying their babies, they have healthier babies. Okay. Be that as it may, that's not a very scientific way of telling you, but it is on the website, and you can find it there. So our science is undertaken at major hospitals and universities around the country. We have the strictest guidelines. We have Nobel laureates working on our science. We have strict oversight bodies. And the normal protocol of medical research starts in the test tube and then moves to laboratory rats and mice and then to humans. That's the way it goes. But PETA wanted us to sign a petition that we would cease all animal testing, and we refused. And they started an online smear campaign calling us murderers, asking people to boycott our juice. And we were naive, and we thought it would go away. And those of you that know Stuart know I am married to John Wayne. And he does not negotiate with terrorists. So on it went for 8 months. And the thing snowballed into a major disaster for our company. Militant animal activist groups joined the fray, and they were camped outside innocent employees' houses. I'm saying not weeks, months. They wore scary masks. They screamed murderers. They had bullhorns. They showed pictures of tortured primates on placards. We never tested on primates. We never would. There were bomb threats, threats against our children. They even went so far as to say that they had poisoned 500 bottles of pomegranate juice on the eastern seaboard. Our stores were so intimidated, they were dropping our product. The morale at headquarters had disintegrated. People were depressed. They were second-guessing everything they were doing. And then one night, and I hate to drop this name, but it actually happened, Rupert Murdoch came for dinner. And he said, "Why do you have to do medical research on juice?" Now, Rupert's fairly smart, whatever you think of his politics or his, you know, desire to own the world. He does drink pomegranate juice every day, and he should know better, but he didn't. It was the disconnect between the juice and the animal testing, I think. Now, most foods never undergo the rigorous science that we have put pomegranate juice through, but we've uncovered that pomegranate juice really is a groundbreaking medical research discovery, and it's in a league of its own. And it's become obvious that palm juice isn't a juice, it's health in a bottle. And I'm not doing an ad here, we've spent $25 million in science. We're very serious about this. It's not a marketing campaign. We really care. We're doing it to give back, because we've been very successful in life, and our palm business is our way of giving back and helping people's health. So, you know, we felt, oh my God, how could they think like this? I mean, we're so wonderful in there here. It doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. So the next day, I took it away from the crisis management people and the lawyers, and Stuart, quite frankly. And I sat down with Fiona, my fabulous head of corporate communication, and the president of Palm, and we took a whole weekend emailing each other back and forth, and we wrote a letter to our retailers, and we wrote an online letter, and we told the truth. Now, the truth was we had stopped animal testing of pomegranate juice in 6 months before, but of course, since we don't negotiate with terrorists, we hadn't said that before. But we told everything that we had discovered. We told the truth about stopping. We also told the truth that we had no intention of stopping animal research on Pomex, which is the little bottle of supplements that you got when you came here. And let me tell you what happened. We put these letters online. The afternoon that we posted the letter, the most horrible, the militant activist group, declared victory and took all the negative publicity about us off their website. That day. 2 days later, PETA did the same thing, even though we never signed their agreement. Sometimes your own truth scares you. Now, if you're lying and you're not telling the truth, you can't do this, obviously. I'm writing a book on marketing, and one of the things that I say is the most important thing about building a brand in today's society is being honest. But we could be honest, we could tell the truth. And it didn't backfire, it made our business. It got our consumers to love us for telling the truth. It got our stores to believe in us again. And I even got flowers from the PETA people, but unfortunately they sent them through 1-800-FLOWERS instead of Teleflora. So that's my story.
So the I want to welcome John Dickerson to the panel. And John has gone from the print media, and he was White House correspondent for, I'm blanking.
Time.
Oh, yeah, time. And but now is a columnist for Slate. So now you're doing online journalism. That's not exactly citizen journalism, but you probably have feedback, and I just like how you look at citizen journalism today.
Boy, do I have feedback. And Time Magazine is different than it was when I left. It is operating in a variety of different spaces now, and so that's changed even in the 2 years I've been gone. I cover politics, and so there's this fantastic experiment going on in politics right now between those of us who cover traditional fashion and citizen journalists, which is, I guess, the fancy euphemism for bloggers. What do I think about this? Some of my colleagues are not huge fans of bloggers and citizen journalists, mostly because a lot of times we're on the receiving end of a lot of hate mail and attacks. Slightly less violent than the palm juice one, but still pretty brutal. So when you write anything, you spend a week defending it. But that can be, you've got a week to spend. I think it's great. The problem is most of us don't have a week. There's no question that a lot of the citizen journalists, I think of Talking Points memo being the best recent example. On this U.S. attorney's scandal, they stayed on the story when a lot of news organizations, which are shrinking, have smaller staff, everybody's under lots of pressure. They see a story and they think, doesn't smell right, and we move on. Talking Points memo didn't, and they stayed on the story, and they broke lots of news and also studied it at a level of detail that even when mainstream organizations got into the story, they didn't get to that level of detail. That's a good news story.
So, David Kirkpatrick, you've been covering the technology for a number of years. You've looked at this area. And with Fortune, you obviously look at the business aspects as well. So I'm just wondering, we've seen some attempts to have Wikinews or We Media or some various citizen journalism approaches that are like pure approaches. And I'd like to just distinguish for a second between just commentary and blogging and people just putting in user-generated content and citizen journalism, which is actually bringing in news and information that would be of use to the public in terms of their citizenship function. But tell us, what do you think of the business model of arising in this area? And you can get into how it's going to be integrated into mainstream media as well.
Well, as a mainstream media person who covers internet, I am sometimes torn in my emotions, because of course I want my own company and business to thrive, but I'm also very aware of the opportunities that are developing in the new world. But I would say in general, I don't worry long term about the opportunity for old media to continue to do its job. But the good thing, as several have said, is that Web 2.0 really is about people. And I'm reminded of a session I moderated here yesterday. This guy named Scott Page, who's a professor at the University of Michigan, gave a talk about his research. He's an economist and a mathematician. His research on diversity and how diversity improves the quality of decision making in almost every system that they study. And they can mathematically demonstrate that. And I would say the good thing about what we've seen with the internet and citizen media and all of its ancillary effects is that there is, on balance, more truth out there, period. I think what John was just saying about the reaction that his articles get, it's annoying as a journalist to write on the internet because of the overwhelming and often very rude response one gets. But the dialogue is genuine, and the dialogue is wider than it would have been before. And I'll tell you, which is slightly off the way you're thinking of the topic, Charlie, but as someone who for over 5 years has been writing both in print and on the internet, you know, and I was a very early person at Fortune to start doing it, and it's only recently my colleagues have realized this, but I get so much more reaction to things I write on the internet compared to things I write in the magazine, you would not believe it. You know, a really controversial magazine story in Fortune might elicit 30 letters, maybe. Time gets a lot more. But Fortune never got that many letters. Well, so maybe for some extremely dramatic thing, we might get a couple hundred, maybe, like over the course of my 20 years at Fortune, that might have happened twice. It's not at all unusual. If I write about, say, outsourcing on my web column, I can easily get 150 emails within a day on that. And I think that's a good thing, even though half of them would basically threaten my life. But you know, and I you can ignore those. But
David, don't you think part of that, so it's because, like, I don't own stamps, right? And so
sure, it's easy.
To
it's an impulsive act.
Yeah. Right. And so, I mean, you've lowered the barrier to participate in the conversation.
That's a
back
good thing.
You.
Yeah. It's a good thing. It's digital. I mean, digital is easier. I mean, I am one of the world's greatest partisans of the notion that because of the internet, in general, the world is getting better. This is just one aspect of that. I am a real, you know, digital optimist. But I do believe that we are seeing it in the media. I think that it makes us better at Fortune to have the reaction we see. I will tell you, as a journalist, I use blogs all the time as sources for my own research, idea generation. I use Wikipedia frequently for fact checking. I often double check it, but I don't always, and it's almost always right. And it's amazing about Wikipedia, as I guess Don said about the London bombing. On almost any major news event, you can go to the Wikipedia article within an hour or two, and it will be updated with really interesting and often better data than you'd get in the New York Times the next day. I found that when I'm writing about breaking news often, and it stuns me. I don't know who the people are that are doing this, although I have learned, by the way, that many of them are librarians who love Wikipedia and are among the most active contributors to it. And you can imagine why. They don't do it for the money. They do it for the information accuracy. That's why they became librarians. Wikipedia is a dream come true for people like that. So, you know, the dialogue is enhanced. There's more truth. Is there a business model for the bloggers? Absolutely. Talking Points Memo is a profitable business. In my arena of technology, we've seen a number of bloggers go off and leave Business 2.0 magazine. Om Malik got a couple $1 million in venture money. He's got a very promising business in GigaOm, which I'm sure Chris reads. I read. It's one of the most authoritative sources for information about telecom and internet stuff. He's now got a staff of at least 3 or 4 people. And he was just a journalist like me who worked for a magazine like one of which we happen to own. And he left, and he's making more money, and he's reaching more people. And that's a good thing. And then you have, you know, somebody like John Battelle, who writes his own blog about search stuff and Chris, and probably is a thorn in Chris's side on numerous occasions because he focuses so much on Google. He wrote a book about Google. But he also is a former publisher from the conventional media. He was the publisher and editor of the industry standard during the dot-com bubble, and he knows how to sell advertising. He has created an advertising network called Federated Media, which sells ads for a very large number of blogs and is quite a successful business. Do you know how many blogs they sell ads for, Chris? It's a lot.
No, but they just lost a few.
But Boing Boing is one that Chris Battelle's very involved in, which is one of the most popular blogs on the internet. And there is a market for advertising on the internet in blog. But, you know, I wanted to just finish by saying, you know, what the real threat is. If there is a threat to conventional media, it doesn't come from the existence of citizen journalism per se. It comes from two things. It comes from the fact that there is a limited market for the user, the reader's time. And people only have so much time to look at stuff. And increasingly, the people who used to read Fortune are reading blogs, they're watching Juiced, They're doing other things that they didn't have the opportunity to do before, and we have to be better in order to retain their time. Very closely related to that is the fact that there is, even though it's growing, there is a limited amount of advertising money out there in the world to spend. And a very large percentage of it is moving to the internet, and that's where the growth is. And it's not just going to blogs, it's going to every internet thing you can imagine, most notably Chris's company, which is by far the most successful media company in the world today, and it's an advertising-supported business, and Google's revenues this year are going to be over $10 billion, and their profits are going to be in a very large percentage of that. And so that money is coming from somewhere. Used to be, we had TV, we had radio, we had magazines and newspapers, basically, and billboards. And now we've got all these places, some of which aren't even, you know, media in the way we would think of them, that can run ads. And so we have to compete with that. And that's a real problem for the conventional media. And I think nobody really knows how it's all going to play out. But my confidence is strong that the quality of what professional journalists do is good enough and different enough and hard enough to achieve that you're not going to see just random people coming out of nowhere replace us. There are more people doing it. Some of them are being financed by advertisements they sell directly themselves. Some of them, like me, are still being financed by advertisements that are being sold by a giant media company. But in the long run, I think the public wants professional reporting, and they will get it in a variety of ways, and I hope Fortune will continue to be among those ways.
So perfect segue into Rob Stengel, who is coming in as a managing editor. Well, you've come in the past year at a time of great crisis in the media. I mean, this is about as tough a job, especially a weekly publication in a world that we think in terms of minutes. How are you handling that? And
great crisis and great opportunity. I mean, I love the term citizen journalism because it's as old as the Republic. We are founded by citizen politicians, citizen legislators, citizen journalists. I mean, Tom Paine was the first citizen journalist in America, and he helped change our country and change the way we are. The politicians were people who felt like we're not necessarily professionals. Anybody can do this. The pamphleteers of the 18th century, you could go into a printer's office and say, hey, print this. There was no mainstream media then. There was no New York Times. There was no Fortune. There was no Time magazine. It was undifferentiated in a way that people could judge in terms of what was the quality of it, what was something that I wanted to read or something that I wanted to know. And that's what is so, I think, wonderful about the blogosphere now, about the realm of citizen journalism, because people can make those judgments. I mean, we have, for example, on time.com, which you have up there, if you scroll down a little bit, we have a blog called Swampland, which is about Washington, D.C. You missed it. A little bit up, and there's a picture of Anna Marie Cox there. So we have professional journalists that David was talking about writing about Washington and politics, but then the amount of postings is just extraordinary. There's hundreds of posts for any posting that one of our journalists put in there. For example, a few weeks ago I was on the Chris Matthews show. I said something that outraged people on the left in the blogosphere. I did a post on Swampland, and in 90 minutes there was 240 posts of people reacting, 90% of them calling me an idiot. And about 80% of what they said was actually pretty smart and legible, and they knew what they were talking about. Even though I'm, you know, more than anybody here, the representative of the traditional mainstream media, I'm a big believer in citizen journalism because it is changing the way we do things. If you mentioned the Macaca moment, Michael Richards' story, the London bombing, all of these things is creating first-person, original data that is fabulous to know. I mean, think about if you had a cell phone in the 18th century and you could have filmed the Constitutional Convention, or in the 19th century and had one at the Civil War. I mean, every historian, every journalist would benefit from that. We would all know so much more. It would all be so much more appealing. The issue for all of us, though, is how do you sort through that? You know, David mentioned how, what is it that modern journalists do? We have people who have incredible expertise, like John about politics or David about technology. And I think people can judge the quality of that when they read it. But in this emerging Web 2.0 world, there are a lot of people who are talking about the journalists of the future, in effect, will become moderators. They are professional moderators who are moderating all of this user-generated content on the one hand and trying to figure out what's valuable, what's not. Because you know what? There's always a hierarchy of stuff. There's a lot of journalists in the mainstream media who have a somewhat elitist attitude about what about user-generated content. But I'm a big believer that this is a democratic with a small d movement. And the users and the readers will be able to figure out what has value and what doesn't. I mean, part of the reason that I think mainstream media in its different iterations will survive is that people realize, wow, that's good. I didn't know that. You know, we have, in our current issue, we had, you mentioned Rupert Murdoch. We had a journalist who spent 2 weeks with him behind the scenes writing about his conquest of the Wall Street Journal. That is something that it's very hard for a citizen journalist to do. And I think people who read that will think, well, wow, that kind of access, that kind of expertise, there's a value there. So I think that is something that will make mainstream media survive. The challenge is how do you use user-generated content? What value does it have? I mean, we joked about putting you on the cover of Time as Person of the Year, and it was about this idea that people are creating content that has value, and that people, as we realize, trust each other often more than traditional sources. I mean, if you look at Amazon.com, I mean, I read them myself, the reviews that citizen reviewers do. All of that has value, and the question is, how do we both monetize it, how do we create greater value of it, and how do we integrate mainstream media with it? There are some things that concern me that we didn't, bring up. I mean, we talked a little bit about advertising. One of the unintended consequences of this world, both good and bad, is that we don't really have the same expectations about privacy that we once had. And, you know, in the old media model, it was gatekeepers talking down to people and people receiving it. That model has gone away. But there's also the model of the fact that very few of us have the kind of privacy expectations that we used to have, and young people in particular have less privacy expectations and probably don't want them. When advertising can pinpoint the fact that you read David Kirkpatrick's blog on Fortune.com and that you like pomegranate juice, and then boom, without you knowing it, you get an ad, in your inbox or on Google when you go there for pomegranate juice, That's a little bit concerning to me, and that's another issue that we haven't really talked about, but it's a consequence of this new world of Web 2.0 and citizen journalism. But in general, I do think there's extraordinary benefits to what we know that we didn't know before.
So suggesting that we're creating a real marketplace of ideas that it'll sift through, and I'd like to get now, and I'll just move along, to how is the citizen going to be more informed under this system? Will we be better informed? And I would like to go out to the audience.
And this goes to politics before. The first presidential campaign I ever covered was 1988. And that was, John, before you were probably at Time. Kurt Anderson was there, and Nancy Gibbs was there, and Walter Isaacson was there. And I was covering the Dukakis campaign, and I carried two suitcases with me, one of clothes and one of Dukakis position papers, texts of his speeches, his history and biography. And as journalists, when the guy is up there giving a speech and you're in this little roped off thing, you get the speech 15 minutes before. And there are hundreds of people there, and you're reading it, and they go, how did you get that? Where did that come from? I mean, all of that information that I carried in a suitcase in 1988 is available to every single person in this room. People are way, way, way more informed than the professional elite was only 20 years ago. And there are lots of benefits to that. And frankly, I think, regular folks, my complaint is that regular citizens don't take enough initiative in their own hands. They know so much, and yet they don't do very much.
I was going to say, that's a very big leap to say all that information is available, and yet people are more informed. I don't necessarily say I'd agree with that.
Let's get some user content. And yes, what I need, this is going to be tough. Is there any way we can move the mic to the people?
Just ask and we'll repeat it.
Okay. Okay, they'll line up. And yeah, while they're lining up, well, hold on.
I had a
one thing I just want to say, the thing that Rick said about, you know, targeted advertising, you think it's getting to be a problem now. I don't see it as much of a problem as you do. It is going to be so unbelievably accurate and pervasive. This will be the way internet content is monetized, and companies like Yahoo and Google are going to make enormous amounts by really knowing so much about us, whether we tell them or not deliberately. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, since time, you know, Anna Marie Cox is a fascinating example, because she was originally a blogger, right? And you hired her.
Right. She was the original Wonkette.
She was the original Wonkette, and you have then sort of sucked her into the more mainstream media. And you did that with Andrew Sullivan also earlier before you were running Time. And I wonder, you know, so many of the blogs that people really read today are actually owned by the mainstream media. That's sort of a new development. And Time has been a real leader in that. Do you think that as bloggers emerge going forward that are really widely read, many of them will end up being owned and operated by people like you?
Well, one of the things that we're experimenting with, and I want to let people ask questions, is to have people contribute to our blogs and then pluck them out of the small d democratic world and make them bloggers for us. I mean, why wouldn't you do that? This is an incredible farm team of seeing what people write and what they think, and why wouldn't you use
that? Without even paying them.
Eventually. That's why they want to work for the mainstream.
We're
going to
go out to the user-generated content, and what I'd like for you to do is identify yourself first and ask a question or a comment. You can comment and not ask a question. That's perfectly fine. Okay.
My name is Mike Klein. I'm involved with something called the Sunlight Foundation, which is an effort to basically do Web 2.0 things involving politics in Washington. I just want to basically add to the perspective of citizen journalism with the kind of stuff that we've done, picking up on the experience that came out of Katrina, where thousands of people were missing, as you may recall. What happened, that was an extraordinary example of very fact-gathering citizen journalism, was that people went out in the net. There was a movement on the internet to help identify where people were who had been lost in New Orleans. And there had been weeks of effort by other ways of doing it. And within a matter of a weekend, about 40% of the people who had been found missing were in fact identified, located, and reunited. So what we have done with earmarks, just to pick a fun example, is we went out and enlisted our readership by posting all of the earmarks that were associated with the Health and Human Resources Services budget, and posted the fact of the earmarks and went out to the internet and to our community and tried to find how those earmarks got there. And we had several thousand people asking their congressmen, going and using research, and ended up with a database that created not only facts about how these earmarks got there, but built up the support for reform of earmarks so that today, in both the House and the Senate, the new rules implemented by this administration require, by the administration, both the House and Senate, require the promoter of an earmark to identify themselves, require them to certify whether or not they have an interest in it personally, like Mr. Hastert did in the highway interchange that made him $2.8 million, and if not them, who does have an interest in it? So enlisting the community that was discussed initially.
Right, that's a great example.
Is in fact what is the most, I think, significant example of citizen journalism.
Right, it's a great example. Talking Points Memo is also
right.
Of actually guiding this force. And bringing in a lot of data points and using that as a method of citizen journalism.
Right, and then the journalistic part of it, which is, say, the analytical component of it, it was Jay Rosen and Dan Gilmore and a lot of the other people who are sort of at the forefront of this move, has editorial control, marshaling the gathered facts by the community into a formulated analytical opinion. And that's, I think, as much citizen journalism as anything you guys have discussed before.
Great. Please.
Thanks. My name's Ellen Davis, and I'm a member of the mainstream media as well. And my question is, well, actually, let me start by saying that we have groups of lawyers and standards and practices people who essentially police everything we do. And I'll be the first to admit that sometimes the mainstream media gets things wrong. But as one of my esteemed correspondents here, Cynthia McFadden, can attest, we get lawyered and we have, you know, we have a lot of accountability and people can sue us, and they do. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about how we might be able to apply those same standards in the world of the internet, if we can, and if we should. I know there's a lot of struggle about how traditional and how laws should be applied on the internet, but in terms of this citizen journalism, I just wonder what your thoughts are. I mean, we can do a lot of harm. We try not to, and I think that this world, which is proliferating the media, can too. So I just wonder what your thoughts are about
how
to police it.
What's the accountability of people who then post and either something irresponsible or something that is just damaging? Anybody want to suggest?
So I would answer this by looking back at what distinguished Google, the original Google, from the other search engines. And that was, if you remember back searching in 1996, 97, 98, you typed in the word flowers, you got, as your first result, the website with the word flowers on it the most number of times. That wasn't necessarily the most relevant response at all. It was just people had gamed the system and put the word flowers up there as many times as possible. What Larry and Sergey set out to do was look at this implicit democracy of the web. They said there are links going everywhere on the web already. And when people write blog posts or web posts back then about flowers, they embed the word flowers in the link and they point to a particular site. And we should look at each one of those pointers as a vote in a way, and sharing the credibility of your own site and your own identity. When you link from your site to another site, you're saying, hey, I'm kind of vouching for where I'm sending you right now. And I think we're seeing the same thing happen within journalism. We're seeing that there are certain bloggers with me whose word is their bond. In fact, I would actually argue that the brand importance of mainstream media, you know, Kirkpatrick means more to me than Fortune, for instance. Mm-hmm. I don't subscribe to Fortune, but I don't miss something he writes.
So reporters and bloggers are becoming their own brands, yeah. And that the big ones and reputable ones are superseding the brand of the publication.
And the sorting is happening by the user. So the sorting is happening either by those I choose to follow, or if you go to a site like dig.com, D-I-G-G.com, where users are actually collaboratively filtering which stories are most important and voting those that have the highest credibility, that are written by people who have a track record, to the top, instead of actually just kind of leaving it into the ether. It's not as disorganized as people would like to think, is what I guess I'd say.
And as an advertiser, I have to tell you that what Google does about getting your particular site on top, according to how many times that word is embedded in your site, is a free form of advertising. And those of you in this room that have businesses, let me tell you, you talk about advertising on the web, this is free. You get the best programmers you can, and you program whatever that keyword is for your business into your site, and you will emerge on top. It's the best buy in advertising today.
That's a brief comment while we then come on up to the mic.
Yeah, just a quick comment. To pick up on this point, one of the most important things is if the blogger is not anonymous, that changes things fundamentally. Like David Kirkpatrick's brand and his reputation is at risk every time he publishes something, so he self-polices.
And timing's money is also at risk.
Yeah. But the point I wanted to make.
They can be sued, and they are sued all
but,
the time.
But you don't go through the corporate lawyers.
Not by, not because of my writing.
David, you don't go through corporate lawyers or do anything differently than writing an article in Fortune, right?
Well, it's interesting. In fact, my print stuff goes through corporate lawyers. My online stuff generally does not.
Okay, and that's
interesting.
That's
I don't know what it means, but that's just the reality.
But that's the point that I wanted to make. And there
doesn't mean it's less laden with liability potentially. Yeah, by the way,
but there are good precedents here in terms of the private sector. Like one of the most popular blogs on the web is Jonathan Schwartz, who's the CEO of Sun Microsystems. And 2 years ago, he made a decision. Anyone in Sun can have a blog, a public blog. And the lawyers in the PR department went ballistic. Like, what are you talking about? Anyone can issue a press release any day. They laid out some guidelines, like, don't say anything stupid. Write about things you know something about. Make it interesting. In 2 years, they've never had an issue.
But there are people who are now without recourse when they are defamed, when they are attacked. And I think it's just a different world, it looks
yeah,
like.
Yeah, now I was talking about the traditional media using blogging, of course. Yeah. You have the flip side.
Yeah,
last week somebody wrote that I have big ears, man. Like, it was
well,
on a very public
not that big. Let's go.
My name is Greg Brodsky. I'm definitely part of the generation that uses wikis and blogs, and I read my friends' blogs. As David and Richard were mentioning, you know, it's kind of an era where there aren't gatekeepers anymore. The challenge isn't getting enough information. There's tons of truth out there. The challenging is filtering that information. I guess my question is about, because we do have limited time to absorb media, and there's so much of it out there, I'm curious what you think the impact is when, you know, there's not just one version of truth. There's really, you know, for 250 million people, there's 250 million truths. And what I find is that people I talk to now, they go more to the sites that kind of reaffirm their own beliefs, because you can't get to all of it. And if you go to Google News, you know, you see 100 different versions of a news story. So in that era where, you know, what do you see as the danger there to popular culture when you really, you could just end up with a variety of different truths for different people?
So, and that leads to this whole issue again of, are the public informed as citizens of the real reason we've put the press, or that they put the press in the only protected industry in the Constitution, was so that the public could be better informed as exercising their citizenship.
That's the only medium that existed.
Well, but it's broad. But do we, you know, are we going to be better informed, or are we going to be all going off to our own reinforced ideas? And
I think that's a little bit of a myth. I mean, one of the critiques of the web by mainstream media originally was that there was no serendipity on it. You could just find the things that confirmed what you thought already. But to me, there's this notion that there is an objective truth is the one that's kind of a fallacy. I mean, that was one of the tried and true beliefs of mainstream media, that there was something that we did that was right and everybody else wasn't. I mean, my dad read the New York Times all of his life. He thinks every word in the New York Times is gospel truth. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore. The challenge for all of us is when there are all of these different truths and these different points of view, and how do you segregate them? How do you moderate them? How do you filter them? I mean, more and more mainstream media will become the filterers, the moderators of all of these different and disparate truths, and I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
Let's go to the next content provider.
My name's Eric Hazeltine. I'm speaking at the Brain Track Saturday and Sunday. What is Web 3.0 going to be?
Don, you want to do that?
I don't know, but it's going to be implanted.
When Richard Branson goes to these planets, he's going to find a finger and a brain. And we're not going to recognize ourselves, but that's how we're going to end up.
Do you want to take that?
I mean, not to be too glib, I think Web 3.0 is an example of version inflation, basically. There are all kinds of speculations and ideas on where the web is going to go, but for right now, we've got our hands full just trying to figure what this current thing means to every institution in society, pretty much.
One thing that I've hypothesized could be a big part of whatever happens in the future is three-dimensionality. And, you know, even though I don't think Second Life is the be-all and end-all, what it does show, it's sort of a proof of concept of the appeal of a space you enter into virtually, which you can not just interact with the way you interact with a page, which is essentially what the web's model has been up to now. In many ways, the web was just taking, like in so many other new technologies, an off old non-tech thing, which was the paper, and putting it into a technologized digital form. But if you can go to a website and interact, go into a space, you're probably going to be able to achieve more things. That will probably be a part of the future web. I wouldn't joke about things being implanted either. I think, you know, the idea of really understanding your thoughts and responding to them effectively, that certainly will happen. It's just a matter of when. Is that going to be Web 3.0 or Web 6.0? I don't know. But it's not 50 years away. It's maybe 10 or 15 years away.
Yeah, I think Web 3.0 ends up being personalized, predictive, and ubiquitous. And we still think about how we think in terms of offline and online, and you still think about your television and your computer as separate devices. And I think they'll continue. I don't think they're all converging in one device. I don't think there's one handheld that will rule them all. But I think these are all going to be concurrently operating constantly online, connected everywhere devices. I mean, it pains me to not have my BlackBerry turned on right now because
turn it on.
No, but it's not. But what's funny is
it hits the microphone.
Because I'm on the Wikipedia all day long. As I hear something, as I react to something, I'm on that, and I think that's going to be increasingly pervasive. I mean, I have a friend who implanted a magnet under her finger and found that her body was actually had absorbed it and had actually become capable of waving it anywhere to become. She's capable of determining whether electric current is flowing through any line.
And so, yeah, wow. Yeah, it's, you can, it's all over the web. You can
so
read all
a
that.
A magnetic yeah. personality.
Yeah.
You know, these Google people.
If anyone was here and saw Randy Hinrichs' presentation on the metaverse, which is what he says is the Web 3.0, it's fascinating, and it is 3D. And it's like the art that's being done on Second Life. If you've never gone to Second Life, you have to go. First of all, you can be the avatar of your dreams. Charlie and I are very tall. And we're divine, and we're ageless. No, but that, as advertisers start to embrace this, and I'm going to do it on all of my sites, I think it's really going to be a fabulous new component of the web.
And just to conclude, that we've moved from center out kind of hierarchical media from the, you know, the filters down. We've now kind of reversed upstream, and so that trend, I think, would just go more and more. I think that is really what people here are saying, more personalized going upstream. Next.
Thank you. My name is Michael Conniff, and forgive me if you've already covered this, but I was late because I was blogging. I actually, I've started a company here called Post Time Media, and we have Aspen Post and Snowmass Post and a bunch of others, but I have really a question about citizen journalism. My experience to date is that it doesn't exist, that there are bloggers and there are journalists, and that when you kind of, that a journalist can morph easily into a blogger, that a blogger cannot morph easily into being a journalist. And just a quick anecdote, I've got an intern that I'm working with who is both learning the ABCs of reporting and also blogging. And just on a day-to-day, hands-on basis, they're completely different. Journalism is getting the facts right, getting names right, getting everything right. Kind of holding back your opinion in many cases. Blogging's the exact opposite. It's all about opinion. And so I just question whether there is, there are exceptions, I'm sure, but in our experience, we have 50 bloggers at Aspen Post, 65,000 monthly visitors, no citizen journalism.
Okay. Let's get, because we're at the end. Radit, did you want to speak? Okay. Yes. Let's get the comments, and then we'll have a final.
Oh, but this, I thought perhaps I was the last speaker. Commentator. I'm Judy Allen. As you can see, I'm of the older generation. I have no children. I have just had a 2-year-old grandniece in my house who arrived 3 hours late from Boulder to Aspen. And the reason is that she is fascinated with her head, and she had taken her potty seat and put it on top of her head and pulled it down on so that it surrounded her neck. I did not know there was a soft part and a hard part of a potty seat, not having any children. I, of course, said, how did you get the thing off of her head? And she said, well, to the mother, Maureen, I used butter. I used mayonnaise. I couldn't get it up. I couldn't get it up. I said, well, did you take her to the emergency room? She said, no, I went to Google and I put potty seat stuck on head. Within seconds, it had come back that a woman in England had had the same problem. And what you do is you go to the fire department, and my Christmas card is now going to be little Sylvia with the potty seat and 6 gorgeous firemen and a saw in hand. Thank you.
Good. Okay, last, Adit, did you want to, last comment?
I'm Edith Harrell Caperton, president of the Worldwide Workshop Foundation. A lot of what we do is trying to educate kids and youth in the States and around the world in developing countries in becoming experts in Web 2.0, blogging, and wiki programming, which is actually requires a great deal of skill. So what will be interesting to hear from the panelists before maybe we jump to Web 3.0 is even in reflection on the pretty narrow educational panel we had yesterday, which is not really taking into consideration a lot of the big ideas that we hear about now. It takes time to develop expertise to become a journalist, an editor, even a person who can write effective letters to the editor that will be accepted and published. What do you think is the future of education so we can really allow everyone to participate in that world, wiki effectively, create communities that are effective, that can influence decisions and policy making, blogging effectively so they can really create a community of people that are responding to their blog, and that it is actually very, very difficult, as you all know, in becoming an effective blogger or journalist in a community of with an architecture of participation.
So kind of citizen and people's literacy in this medium to actually produce. And if anybody would like to make a comment and also a conclusory comment, because we have reached the end of the hour, we're going to hold over a little bit because we started a little bit late, but I know we need to wrap up.
You know, while I do think anybody can commit journalism,
as the old saying is, the mainstream traditional journalists, as we've mentioned before, do things that bloggers don't do. They have their stories read by lawyers. They're checked. All of the things are gone over several times. I mean, people in the user-generated content world don't necessarily do that, and there is a distinction. I mean, we spend millions of dollars having 10 people in Baghdad right now as we speak. I mean, bloggers have a hard time doing that. So there always will be this distinction, but I think the distinction is more blurred than it ever was before.
I did identify myself as a digital utopian before, but I would just point out that everyone in this room and everyone pretty much in global developed world society writes more than they ever wrote before for one reason, and doesn't everybody know what it is? Email. So writing, in many ways, is a better skill, I think, culturally than it was before, but that doesn't mean that we can all write letters to the editor to get published, but I think email has helped people learn to communicate better.
And I think one thing that I see that scares me is an elitism about form of communication, that all of us who paid too much money to go to private schools and learn how to write correct sentences, I think we tend to reflexively be elitist about people who don't capitalize or who write with conjunctions, and our kids who write using instant messaging and things like that. And I actually see my generation and generations above me rejecting the content that comes from these communications because of their form and not actually looking at the underlying substance, and it frustrates me a lot. I actually gave up capitalizing recently. I figured it's just an extra keystroke and it's kind of a waste of time. But I implore all of you to kind of reach out to younger people and look at the substance of their message and not rule it out by its form.
Okay, Linda?
Yes, I just want to say that don't be afraid of this new web, too. You know, I just got an email from someone that works for me telling me that there is another session where they're trashing Fiji water. You know, and then there'll be a blog about it, and it'll be all over the internet. And even my friend Chris has been an opponent of Fiji water being shipped from Fiji. But you know what? As the owner of these companies, I'm happy that the dialogue exists. And I think in the end, the truth will out. And I think we should all be happy that we're alive in this time. It's the most exciting time in the world.
Great. John, I'm going to have you go last. Okay. John?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a reiteration of what's been said before about the amount of available time we have. And there is a wonderful self-sorting function of the fact that we all do have to learn to write with email. And if we're not writers already, the better writer you are, even if you're in business, you'll get beaten by a better writer. To the extent that somebody that competes with you in your business can write faster, smarter emails, they will win. So in some ways, we're all in the natural process of competition, training ourselves to be better writers, because it's the way through which we communicate ideas now. The only thing I would say about capitalization and all of the form questions is that it's still, if you have a limited amount of time, 7 screens of your view of Barack Obama is maybe great if you've got time to read 7 screens. And so that there are some of the old rules are not just old Victorian niceties. They're about getting communication across as fast as possible and as smartly as possible.
Let me pick up this issue of young people, because I think if you want to understand the future of citizen journalism and the media in general, you'll understand it by looking at the way youth are using it.
John wrote a whole book about it, by the way.
Growing up digital.
And that was 10 years ago. And when I wrote that book, but now these kids, the eldest, they're the baby boom echo. And the eldest of these kids are 28, and they're coming into the workforce and the marketplace, and they're different. Their parents grew up, the baby boomers, watched 24 hours a week of television per boomer. And these kids come home, and they don't turn on the TV, they turn on their computer, and they're in 3 different windows, and they're listening to MP3 files, and yeah, they still got a couple of magazines open, and they're doing their homework, and the TV's going on in the background. But what's happening is the whole way that they interact with media is totally different. And all a lot of the stuff that you read about them, oh, they're not informed, they don't read the newspaper, they get their news on the Daily Show. This is just not, it's just not supported by the research and by the data. The Daily Show isn't funny unless you know the news. These kids are enormously informed. Newspaper readership is way down. They're getting their news differently, and they're also increasingly creating and co-innovating and co-creating news. Okay. So I think in their culture, you'll find the new culture of the media.
So we're seeing a broader marketplace of ideas, that some of those ideas are good, some bad. We sort of a wisdom of the crowds type of approach in the new media. We're seeing the journalistic functions are arising, but basically through a reputation system that's culling out who are the journalists and that you should look at. And we're seeing that the new media are interacting and becoming part of the mainstream media and vice versa. So it is a new era of journalism. It's a crisis time, but a very interesting one. I want to thank the panelists for a great job.